A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. Not in the abstract sense, but in the lived-through-it sense. Over the past year, he and his family weathered two Iran wars, a landlord-induced displacement, and a six-month housing crisis that all fed into each other. His core question is about what he calls the cascade spiral. That moment when one destabilizing event erodes your capacity to handle the next, and suddenly you're not dealing with a crisis, you're dealing with a chain reaction. The thing he wants to zero in on is the art of grounding yourself mid-spiral, so pressured decisions don't make everything worse, and he's asking whether the same dynamics apply to organizations, not just families.
This is the kind of topic where the personal and the analytical genuinely need each other. Because the cascade spiral isn't just bad luck or a rough year, it's a structural failure mode, and I think most preparedness advice completely misses it.
Let me break down what I mean by the cascade spiral, because I think it's the most dangerous thing I've ever encountered as a prepper. The standard approach to preparedness is scenario-based. You prepare for 3 days without water. You prepare for a financial emergency. You prepare for a medical event. Each preparation sits in its own bucket. But the cascade spiral doesn't live in any bucket. It lives in the seams between buckets. It's what happens when your preparation for event A gets consumed by event A, and then event B arrives and you're naked.
The timeline Daniel described is almost a textbook case. Iran War number 1 in late 2025. That's the initial destabilization. You're already operating at reduced capacity. Then an apartment leak appears, and because the landlord drags his feet, it propagates into a serious structural issue. You're trying to manage that while still in the aftermath of a conflict. Then Iran War number 2 hits in May, lasts a full month, and you're moving a 1-year-old to and from a communal shelter multiple times a day because your building has no shelter of its own. That level of sustained disruption consumes every reserve you have.
This is where the cascade spiral gets vicious. The exhaustion from the war directly reduced Daniel's capacity to negotiate with the landlord when he asked for a repair timeline, which is a completely reasonable request. The landlord retaliated by terminating the lease. Now you've got displacement layered on top of active conflict. And the rental market in Israel had already spiked about 12% in the second quarter of 2026, so you're hunting for housing in a market that's been scrambled by the same war that displaced you.
That 12% figure is brutal because it's not just a number. It means every family displaced by the conflict is competing for the same diminished pool of rentals. The market itself becomes a cascade amplifier.
Daniel's point about the cascade spiral being more dangerous than any single catastrophe, I think that's exactly right, and here's why. A single catastrophe, however severe, has boundaries. You know what you're dealing with. You can triage. But a cascade spiral erodes your ability to triage because the ground keeps shifting under you. Each new event arrives before you've stabilized from the last one, and your decision-making quality degrades with each iteration.
To understand why the cascade spiral is so dangerous, we need to look at what happens inside your brain when crisis piles on crisis. There's a well-documented shift that occurs under acute stress. You move from what researchers call System 2 thinking, which is deliberative and analytical, to System 1 thinking, which is reflexive and pattern matching. System 2 is expensive. It consumes glucose, it requires working memory, it needs time. System 1 is fast and cheap. And when you're exhausted, when you've been moving a toddler to a shelter multiple times a day for weeks, your brain defaults to System 1 because it simply doesn't have the resources for anything else.
The tunnel vision effect. You can only see the immediate threat. And the problem is, in a cascade spiral, the immediate threat is rarely the one that's going to do the most damage. The immediate threat is the loudest one. The landlord's lease termination feels like the crisis, so you respond to that. But the knock-on effect. 6 months of displacement during a housing shortage is actually the bigger threat, and it's nearly invisible in the moment because your brain has narrowed its aperture.
There's a concept in crisis decision-making research that I think maps perfectly onto this. Under sustained stress, people experience something called cognitive depletion, which is essentially a budget problem. You have a finite amount of executive function each day. Every decision, even small ones, draws from that budget. During normal life, you replenish it with sleep, with downtime, with routine. During a cascade spiral, you're making high-stakes decisions continuously while the replenishment mechanisms are themselves disrupted. You're not sleeping well because there are rockets. You have no downtime because you're managing displacement logistics. The budget runs a deficit, and the deficit compounds.
This is where Daniel's specific decision chain is so instructive. War creates the shelter problem. The shelter problem means moving a one-year-old hourly during alerts. That creates exhaustion. The exhaustion reduces negotiation capacity with the landlord. The reduced capacity leads to lease termination. The lease termination creates displacement. The displacement lands in a market that's been inflated by the war. Each link in the chain is a decision made under increasing cognitive depletion. By the time you reach the displacement phase, you're running on fumes.
The cruelest part is that the decisions you make under cognitive depletion often look reasonable in isolation. Asking for a repair timeline is reasonable. Accepting displacement rather than fighting a legal battle during wartime is reasonable. But the cumulative effect of these reasonable decisions is a trajectory you would never have chosen if you could have seen the whole picture from the start.
That's the cascade spiral's signature. It doesn't announce itself. It feels like you're just dealing with things, one at a time, making the best call you can. And then 6 months later, you look up and realize you've been in a continuous crisis that was never really about any single event.
I want to introduce a framework here that I think is useful, and it comes from aviation. Pilots are trained in a priority sequence: aviate, navigate, communicate. In that order. Aviate means keep the aircraft flying. Stabilize the fundamental thing that keeps you alive. Navigate means figure out where you are and where you're going. Communicate means talk to air traffic control, declare an emergency, coordinate. The order is non-negotiable because if you skip to communicate before you've stabilized the aircraft, you crash. It doesn't matter how good your radio call was.
The cascade spiral is what happens when you try to communicate before you've stabilized the aircraft. In Daniel's case, the equivalent of communicate was engaging with the landlord on the repair timeline. A reasonable thing to do, but it was attempted before the fundamental stabilization had happened. He was still in an active war zone, still managing the child's safety, still sleep-deprived. The aircraft wasn't stable.
The aviation analogy holds up really well under examination. When a pilot faces an emergency, the training overrides the instinct. The instinct is to fix the problem immediately, to do something. The training says, first, fly the plane. Even if the engine is on fire, fly the plane first. Because if you stop flying the plane to deal with the fire, you've just created a second emergency that's worse than the first.
That's the counterintuitive skill Daniel is pointing at. The hardest thing to do when the earth is shaking is to stabilize yourself rather than try to stop the shaking. The instinct is to solve the problem. The correct instinct, the trained instinct, is to first create a platform of stability, however minimal, from which you can then act.
This connects to something I observed repeatedly in my years in pediatric medicine. When a child comes in with a complex trauma, multiple injuries, systems failing, the worst thing a doctor can do is try to fix everything at once. You stabilize the airway first, then breathing, then circulation. And the discipline is that while you're securing the airway, you are actively ignoring the broken leg. Not because the leg doesn't matter, but because it won't matter if the child stops breathing.
The broken leg is the lease termination. The airway is having a safe place to sleep tonight.
And the cognitive trap is that the broken leg is visible and demanding attention, while the airway problem is quieter but existential. In a cascade spiral, the loudest problem is rarely the most dangerous one.
We know the mechanism. The question is, what do you actually do when you're in the middle of it? How do you ground yourself when the earth is already shaking?
Daniel's own experience contains the answer, and I want to pull it apart carefully. After the lease termination, his reflexive response could have been to immediately start searching for a new apartment. That's what the urgency demands. You've just lost your housing. Every instinct says find housing now, but he didn't do that. Instead, he first secured temporary housing with family. He accepted the loss of autonomy, which is painful, to prevent the worst outcome, which would have been homelessness or a desperate, overpriced lease signed under duress.
That's the stabilization before optimization principle in action. The temporary housing was ugly. It wasn't the solution anyone wanted, but it stopped the bleeding. It created a platform, however imperfect, from which the 6-month surge could be conducted with at least some cognitive resources restored.
I think it's worth naming explicitly that ugly is often the correct choice in a cascade spiral. There's a cultural narrative around crisis management that valorizes grace under pressure, the heroic figure who handles everything with composure. That narrative is actively harmful because it sets an impossible standard that pushes people toward overreach. The reality is that survival often means making choices that look like failures from the outside. Taking the imperfect shelter. Letting some things break so that other things don't.
The heroic narrative also creates a weird kind of shame spiral that feeds the cascade. You feel like you should be handling this better, so you try harder, which depletes you faster, which leads to worse decisions, which makes you feel like you're failing, which makes you try even harder. It's a doom loop.
Organizations do exactly the same thing. I've seen startups where a funding crunch coincides with a product failure, and the founding team tries to solve both simultaneously. They pivot the product while also running a fundraising process, while also managing a team that's starting to panic. Each effort cannibalizes the others. The correct move, the aviate move, is to extend runway first, even on ugly terms, so that you have the cognitive and financial bandwidth to make a good product decision later.
The organizational parallel is so clean it's almost uncomfortable. In both cases, the cascade spiral consumes what organizational theorists call slack, the excess capacity that lets a system absorb shocks. A healthy family has slack, savings, social connections, emotional reserves, time. A healthy organization has slack, cash reserves, talent depth, operational redundancy. The cascade spiral is what happens when each crisis consumes the slack that would have buffered the next one, until you're running with zero margin.
Here's the preparedness paradox Daniel hinted at. The more you prepare for discrete scenarios, the more you may underestimate your vulnerability to cascading failures. You've got your 3 days of water, you've got your bug-out bag, you've got your financial buffer. And those things are useful. Daniel said his preparations came in handy, but they're all designed for event A. What happens when event A consumes those preparations and event B arrives before you've replenished?
Your water storage doesn't help you negotiate with a hostile landlord. Your bug-out bag doesn't find you a new apartment in a 12% inflated rental market. The real preparedness gap isn't logistical. It's psychological and procedural. It's the ability to recognize that you're in a cascade spiral and shift into a different decision-making mode.
Let me offer a concrete framework for that shift. First, recognize you're in a cascade spiral. This sounds trivial, but the act of naming changes your relationship to the situation. Instead of feeling like you're failing at handling a series of discrete problems, you recognize that you're experiencing a known failure pattern with predictable dynamics. That alone reduces some of the panic.
Naming it also helps you stop blaming yourself for not handling everything gracefully. You're not disorganized. You're in a cascade spiral. That's a structural condition, not a character flaw.
Second, accept that you will not solve everything at once. This is the hardest step because it goes against every instinct. The cascade spiral creates a sense of overwhelming urgency. Everything feels like it needs to be solved right now. But the urgency is partly an artifact of cognitive depletion. Not everything actually needs to be solved right now. Some things can wait. Some things will break. Accepting that is not defeatism. It's triage.
This is where I think the prepper mindset can actually work against you. Preppers are solution-oriented by nature. We see a problem, we want to solve it. But in a cascade spiral, the impulse to solve everything is exactly what drives the spiral deeper. You need to be willing to let some fires burn while you focus on the one that's closest to the gas line.
Third, identify the single stabilizing action that prevents the worst compounding effect. Not the action that solves the biggest problem, the action that prevents the situation from getting materially worse in a way that would foreclose future options. For Daniel, that was securing temporary housing. For an organization facing simultaneous crises, it might be securing bridge funding or freezing non-essential operations to preserve cash. The question is, what's the one thing that, if you do it now, buys you the breathing room to make better decisions tomorrow?
The key word there is one. Not three things, not a prioritized list. Because in a cascade spiral, your executive function is depleted. You don't have the bandwidth for a multi-pronged response. Pick one stabilizing action and execute it with full focus.
Fourth, execute that action with full focus, ignoring everything else. This is where the aviation discipline really bites. While you're securing the temporary housing, you are not also searching for permanent housing. You're not also fighting the landlord. You're not also optimizing your bug-out bag. You're doing one thing. Everything else is noise.
The discipline of ignoring things during a crisis is countercultural. We're trained to believe that more effort and more attention are always better. But attention is a finite resource, and in a cascade spiral, it's already overdrawn. Focus isn't just helpful. It's the only thing that works.
I want to bring in the caregiving dimension here because Daniel's situation involved a one-year-old, and that changes the calculus dramatically. You can't outsource emotional regulation to a toddler. During a month-long conflict with no shelter in the building, you're not just managing your own stress. You're managing a child's experience of that stress while also trying to maintain some semblance of routine for feeding and sleep. The cognitive load of caregiving during a cascade spiral is multiplicative, not additive.
The child's routine becomes a stabilization anchor in itself. Even if everything else is chaos, maintaining the toddler's sleep schedule and mealtimes creates a structure that benefits both the child and the parent. It's a form of aviate, keeping the small human stable so that you can then navigate the larger crisis.
From a pediatric perspective, children are remarkably resilient when they have at least one stable adult presence. They don't need the situation to be perfect. They need one person who is, as much as possible, present and regulated. Which means that taking care of your own stabilization isn't selfish. It's directly in service of the child's well-being. If you collapse, they lose their anchor.
That's a point that doesn't get made enough in preparedness circles. Self-care during crisis isn't indulgence. It's a strategic requirement. If you're the anchor for a child, or an elderly parent, or anyone who depends on you, your stability is infrastructure. Letting it degrade isn't noble. It's a single point of failure.
Let me distill this into three concrete things you can do, not for next time, but right now, before the next cascade hits.
First, pre-audit your cascade vulnerabilities. Look at your preparedness setup and ask, what happens if my emergency fund gets consumed by one crisis and a second hits immediately after? What happens if my backup housing option is also affected by the same regional event that displaced me? Map the seams between your preparations. Then build what I'd call cascade buffers. Extra cash beyond your standard emergency fund. An emotional support network that isn't just one person. Contingency housing options that aren't all in the same geographic area. These buffers are specifically designed for overlapping failures, not single events.
The cascade buffer concept is important because standard emergency funds are sized for one crisis at a time. 6 months of expenses sounds like a lot until you burn through 3 months of it during a war and then face a displacement that requires first month, last month, and a security deposit in an inflated rental market. Suddenly, 6 months of normal expense savings is more like 2 months of crisis, expense reality.
Second, practice the stabilization reflex. There's a mnemonic from survival training. Stop, stop, think, observe, proceed. In a cascade spiral, the first action is usually wrong because it's reflexive. The second action, taken after even a 30-second pause, is usually better. Train yourself to pause before acting in a crisis. It feels wrong. Every instinct says to move fast. But the pause is what prevents you from solving the wrong problem.
I've seen this in clinical emergencies. The most dangerous moment is the first 30 seconds when everyone's adrenaline is up and the impulse is to do something, anything. The best clinicians I worked with had trained themselves to use those 30 seconds to observe and think, not to act. The action that follows is faster and more accurate because it's aimed at the right target.
Third, build a crisis triage hierarchy for your family or organization. Pre-decide what you will sacrifice first, so you don't have to make that decision under fire. Daniel's implicit hierarchy, from what he described, was safety of child first, then housing stability, then financial cost, then convenience. Having that hierarchy explicit means that when the cascade hits, you already know what you're willing to lose. You're not agonizing over whether to spend more money to secure housing faster. You've already decided that financial cost ranks below housing stability.
Organizations need this too. A startup should know, before the crisis hits, whether it will sacrifice team size, product scope, or valuation to survive. Making that decision in advance, when you're not cognitively depleted, produces a much better answer than making it in the middle of a funding crunch while your best engineers are updating their LinkedIn profiles.
The triage hierarchy also reduces guilt. If you've pre-decided that convenience is the lowest priority, then when you have to accept an inconvenient temporary housing situation, it doesn't feel like a failure. It feels like executing the plan.
Here's the question I want to leave you with, and I don't have a complete answer. How do we design preparedness systems that account for the cascade spiral, not just discrete events? What would a cascade resilient family or organization actually look like?
I think part of the answer is that cascade resilience looks less like a checklist and more like a practice. It's not about having the right supplies, those supplies matter. It's about having trained the right reflexes. The willingness to stabilize ugly before optimizing pretty.
I think another part is that cascade resilience requires redundancy in relationships, not just resources. Daniel's temporary housing came from family. That's a relationship buffer, not a financial one. Organizations have something similar. It's called reputational capital, the goodwill that makes a lender extend terms or a key customer stick around during a rough patch. You build that before the crisis, not during it.
As global volatility increases, climate disasters, geopolitical conflicts, economic instability, the cascade spiral is going to become the dominant failure pattern. The skill of grounding yourself mid-crisis may be the most important meta skill of the coming decade. It's not about preventing all cascades, which is impossible. It's about recognizing them early and stabilizing before they compound.
That's a skill you can practice in small ways. The next time you have a bad day where multiple things go wrong in sequence, a work crisis, a family emergency, a financial surprise, treat it as cascade spiral practice. Pick the one stabilizing action. Ignore the rest. Build the muscle in low-stakes situations so it's there when the stakes are existential.
If this episode resonated with you, if you've lived through your own cascade spiral, or you're rethinking your preparedness approach, we'd love to hear about it. Rate and review the podcast, and send us your stories. We may feature them in a future episode.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for making this show happen.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, Honduran farmers cultivating the heirloom maize variety known as Olotilo discovered that soaking the kernels in water infused with the petals of the jacaranda tree produced a vivid indigo pigment that local weavers used to dye cotton textiles, a process that chemically relied on the same anthocyanin compounds that give purple corn its distinctive color.
I had no idea jacaranda petals contained anthocyanins in dye usable concentrations.
Of course you didn't.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.